Welcome to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have as guests today for the first time Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, and we will be discussing their new novel, The Wheel of Darkness, which debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list last week and is a fascinating read and one that I recommend that all the listeners read because it really is a very entertaining and well-written novel. And first of all, Lincoln, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me, Casey.
Now, with The Wheel of Darkness, one of the things that stands out with a Douglas Preston Lincoln Child novel is you really write a really panoramic novel, which is very entertaining. And I noticed stylistically that you guys like to write a lot of chapters. And is that something that you do intentionally to keep the pace moving?
I think it has developed over the course of all of our books. We tend to write very cinematically. At least, you know, speaking for myself, I think I imagine each scene very very visually in my head as I write it, and not because I'm writing to write for the movies at all, but just because I find it helps to visualize the story that way. And I also find that writing short chapters, short punchy chapters, is a great way to keep the momentum going. And we often get emails from very irritated readers who sat down to read just a few chapters before bed and ended up reading the whole book, you know, and are now tired the next day and blaming us for it because they succumbed to that just one more chapter syndrome.
Yes, yes. Lincoln, one of the things that I think makes your work different from other authors is that I believe that you give the readers of your novels, you give them the benefit of the doubt that they're going to get what you're doing and what you're writing about, which I find refreshing as a reader.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We don't write down to our readers. We try to write clever, you know, interesting, fast-moving books in which our readers will find themselves oftentimes in a place or a discipline they wouldn't otherwise know about, whether it's archaeological dig in remotest Utah looking for the remains of Anasazi Indians, or it's an engineering expedition to the tip of South America to try and bring back the world's heaviest meteorite. You know, or some horrendous confrontation, you know, in a sub-basin of the Museum of Natural History. We add a lot of science other, you know, material sprinkled in among the excitement and the mayhem and the violence, and that's something else that our readers pick up on. That we're not trying to write simplistic books. You know, we know that readers appreciate an interesting and fresh story, and that's what we try to give them as much as we can every time we write together.
Mm-hmm. And when we're discussing The Wheel of Darkness, your protagonist Aloysius Pendergast is a much loved character, and in this book, the Constance Greene, his ward, are really front and center. And was that an intentional thing that you guys did when you were writing this one to kind of put the focus on Pendergast with this novel?
Yes, we just came off of a series of books we call the Diogenes Trilogy, where it had a very large ensemble cast of characters. And we felt that it was time to really showcase Pendergast by himself again and let him really have a star turn. And having the action take place aboard the world's largest luxury liner on his maiden voyage across the Atlantic aided that, you know, because we have a cast of people on the ship, you know, the crew and some of the wealthy guests. It really let us shine the light on both Pendergast and Constance Greene. Oddly enough, we had originally planned to have Pendergast's sidekick being Corey Swanson, the young woman from Still Life with Crows, because we had a lot of people who have been clamoring to see her in another book. Unfortunately, when it came down to it, we felt that just because of the kind of high-class, elegant ship it was, that Constance would be a better companion, a better able to help Pendergast solve the mystery. Corey would probably be more of a disruptive influence, and annoy people rather than further the investigation. So, but she'll come back again in some future book.
Mm-hmm. And the Wheel of Darkness opens in Tibet, and I really enjoyed the, like you say, the cinematic quality. And there, on page 34, one of the monks says, "When the earth is drowning in selfishness, greed, violence, and evil, the Agosian will cleanse the earth of its human burden." And I really liked that sentence. I thought it really kind of summarized, you know, where the novel was at that point in time.
Well, I have to give credit where credit is due, and Doug knows a lot about Buddhism and about Tibet, and those, a lot of those passages were his, and he did a great job with that. And, you know, what people have to realize is that, well, these are, of course, these are novels. We do try and include as much, you know, true material as we can, filtered through the lens of fiction, of course. For example, there's something that we learn about in the book called an immured anchorite, which is a monk that basically is sealed off inside a tiny room for the rest of his life. And it sounds like a bizarre phenomenon, but you know, in the course of our research, we find out that this indeed does happen, and there are anchorites just like that. So sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
Mm-hmm. And Douglas, when you write those scenes, do you pretty much, like the scene in Tibet, is that something that you will work on and do the research and fact finding and write that part of it? Because
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is. Sometimes we do divide up the writing like that, where, you know, Lincoln will have a specialty and he'll write the chapters involving that particular, you know, knowledge that he has, and then I'll write the chapters involving my knowledge.
And you guys, I think I love it because you kind of push the envelope, and sometimes there's almost a poetic aspect to your work where some of the word selection you use, I find it very, very appealing. And I'm wondering, sometimes do you guys talk to each other and say, this word might be a little over the edge?
Well, sometimes we do get emails from people saying, you know, I had to run to the dictionary 3 or 4 times while reading, you know, book X. But it's never done in a censorious way. They always seem to be pleased to have learned this. And Doug and I try very hard to keep our writing at a high level, but not in any way, you know, stuck up or
offensive. Right.
Well, we have to do something with our English major degrees.
Now let's discuss the Britannia, which is almost a character in itself of the Wheel of Darkness, and it's a kind of a maiden voyage for a major ocean liner. And if you would tell the listeners why you chose this format to write in, because it almost has a feel of a locked room mystery as you're reading it, which I really like.
Well, we originally were planning to set the story in a fictitious suburb reminiscent of where Doug and I both grew up. I grew up in Westport, Connecticut, and he grew up in Wellesley, and we were going to set the mayhem and violence in Wellsport. But as time went on, we realized that this was just not a very interesting setting for a story to take place. And we were getting very depressed because, you know, the time was growing very short. And then one day I happened to catch a glimpse of the Queen Mary II leaving port in New York, and I realized instantly that, you know, a grand luxury ship of our own devising, so we could lay it out and orchestrate the terrible events as best we could see it. You know, our own fictitious ship, the hugest, most grandiose and luxurious ship ever, would be a perfect setting, not only for a locked door mystery, as you say it, but we could do whatever we want with it. We could sink it. We could run it up on some rocks. You know, it's our little pretend boat to do it as we saw fit. And I called Doug and sketched it out, and immediately he was as excited as I was, and he went to work right away, you know, helping to envision the most fantastic ship that we could possibly craft our joint imaginations around.
And the interesting thing about a ship like this is that, you know, once it leaves a port and is in international waters, there's no legal or investigative entity really in charge of it. I mean, an ocean liner in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is not part of any national territory. And so any kind of investigation that takes place, any murders, any crimes that take place, the jurisdiction is very uncertain. Who is to investigate these crimes? And so we like that aspect of it, too. It's like a city floating in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean with no real police force, no laws, nothing governing it. I mean, we really realized we could have a lot of fun with this particular setting.
Absolutely. And the staff of the Britannia play an important role. Commodore Cutter is a very interesting character, and I found Captain Mason who's a female captain, I found her to be just a fascinating character.
Well, Doug did an immense amount of research on how a ship like that is operated. He can tell you more about that than I can. There's not even a wheel anymore, right, Doug?
That's right. Well, it's fascinating. The bridges of these enormous ships now look more like the control room of a nuclear power plant than they do a traditional ship's bridge. I mean, there isn't even a wheel. A little tiny joystick will control an engine that produces 21.5 megawatts of power. Just an unbelievable technology running these ships. They've got all the latest in chart plotters and GPS systems and radar and so forth. And what you're looking at, there are computer screens and, you know, electronic charts and things like that. And so the whole, so we had a lot of fun really going into detail about how the bridge of our ship works, what kind of electronic equipment is there, how the various officers on the bridge are relating to each other and how they're guiding the ship through the storms and through, you know, into port and so forth.
It's ironic because we were congratulating each other on what a clever title The Wheel of Darkness was. Not only does it relate to the recitation you mentioned earlier in this talk, but also it reflected on the ship's wheel, which would play a very important part in the action later in the story, only to find out, of course, there is no actual wheel on a ship like the Britannia.
There is actually a wheel in our ship, but it's fake. It's just there for the benefit of the passengers who come in to the ship's bridge, and they expect to see a beautiful mahogany and brass wheel. But it's not connected to anything.
And that kind of fits in with, I think, one of the really interesting aspects of the Wheel of Darkness is that a lot of what happens on this ship is largely ceremonial. And when they really kick the tires on it in terms of the security and, like you were saying, Doug, the police force, I mean, it really is. I was thinking to myself, what can go wrong next? And I wasn't even close to, you know, the magnitude of what can go wrong on a ship like that.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, the Titanic is an interesting precedent. I mean, there was a ship that they thought was unsinkable. It was the latest in technology. Anytime human beings get arrogant and think they've built something that's unsinkable or perfect, nature takes them down.
Mm-hmm. If you guys would you both just kind of respond to one of the things that I think that a common theme in this is, and really a lot of your work, is the influence that greed plays in our society today. And I know that's kind of a broad question, but I think greed permeates a lot of different levels of this novel.
Well, we use Constance Greene as a mouthpiece for that. You know, she does a scene in the book where she wanders through the vast public areas of the ship and watching, you know, these pampered, wealthy people being served, you know, by the wait staff, and how she's repulsed by what she sees. And it is true that you know, on a ship like this, you would find a huge difference in the strata between the helper and the helped. Of course, it varies, I'm sure, from line to line, but it happens in other books of ours, too, and this was the perfect opportunity to really explore that in greater depth than we have before.
You know, it's almost a symbol that our ship is a symbol, a palace, a floating palace to greed and self-indulgence. I mean, people take a cruise like this, and we don't mean to sound, you know, self-righteous about this, but, you know, the whole experience on board a luxury ocean liner like this is one of eating, drinking, and indulging yourself in every possible whim. But what people don't see on ships like the Queen Mary II and others are the conditions of the people below decks who are serving them. I mean, they are, first of all, they are often, and I'm not saying this specifically about the Queen Mary, but they're grossly underpaid. The labor laws on the high seas don't exist. They live in incredibly cramped quarters. It's exactly the opposite. You have, you know, this top tier of luxury and self-indulgence, and then you have this bottom tier of people who are worked half to death and paid almost no money for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to step in and say that we, like I said earlier, there are variations in level, and we can't speak to any particular cruise line how they treat their people. But in our research, we found out that some are treated better than others, and some are treated very poorly indeed.
Our guests today are Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. We're discussing The Wheel of Darkness, published by Warner Books. And I'd also like to mention that the Book of the Dead is available in paperback now. So one of the things that, Lincoln, you and I were talking about earlier is The Wheel of Darkness, you can pick this book up and read it. And if you haven't read the other books that you two have written, I think you can jump into this book and it stands alone very effectively. You don't miss any of the backstory.
Intentionally to be a book that could be read on its own. You know, we preceded this by a trilogy of books, which we call the Diogenes Trilogy, in which it really is better if they're read in order. And we didn't intend to write a trilogy. The story sort of got away from us and became a three-book series. And coming off of that, we wanted specifically to write a book that was stood by itself, it was fast and brutal, and when it ended, that was the end. At least that was the end as much as any of our books have an ending to them.
When it comes to the creativity of the overall story, are you guys pretty much on the same page? Have you learned to work with each other to where when one of you goes off and really writes something supernatural or metaphysical, which is really challenging, do you kind of rein each other in sometimes, or you just say, I would take that and really run with it? How do you guys handle that aspect of your novels?
Well, we certainly do rein each other in. I sent Lincoln some chapters, and he'll call me up, and in as nice a way possible, he'll say to me, Doug, these chapters stink. And, you know, in a sense, I'm glad that we can be direct with each other. I do the same thing to him. That isn't to say we don't have arguments or disagreements about stuff. But then there are other times when Lincoln will call me up or send me something he's written, and it's not what I expected. It is not what we planned or outlined, and it's absolutely brilliant. And in those cases, we certainly do run with it. I mean, there's nothing worse than writing a book by the numbers. You know, we often find ourselves departing from our outlines, and it's often these strokes of genius that suddenly will turn the book in a different direction that we don't expect.
We do rein each other in on numerous occasions, and that helps to keep the books, you know, tight and fast-moving. There are occasions, though, when one of us will write some inspired passage that eggs the other one on to adding to it. And we occasionally like to go over the top in places where, you know, at particularly climactic moments, it really pays off. So it goes both ways.
And Lincoln, do you sometimes tell Doug that you were his editor prior to you guys working together and you have final say?
No, I would never tell that I have final say. I mean, if I felt particularly strongly about a point, I would argue it passionately. But, you know, so far we've managed to always work it out. And what we usually say to people is that in cases like that, the one who yells the loudest gets his way because, you know, he has a conviction, and so he probably is right about this, whatever that this might be.
Mm-hmm. And Doug, does it help that I'm sure it helps that Lincoln was worked with you as an editor prior to the two of you forming a partnership, and I would imagine that makes you feel comfortable sometimes when he says, hey, I think you're going over the top a little bit with that.
Well, it does. I've learned to trust his judgment. He was a brilliant editor. And he's got very keen judgment. And, I mean, most writers are overly wedded to their material. They, you know, when I send Lincoln something, I think it's just absolutely perfect. It's deathless prose, and how dare he touch it? And then when he reworks it, I'm furious. But in the end, I can always see the reasons for him doing the things he does.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, early on in our writing partnership, you know, I had written a lot as a kid, but in college and later years, my writing got more and more sort of baroque, and it got harder and harder to write. You know, I was so slow in examining every sentence, it became very painful. And watching Doug take an outline that I had written and turn it into a living, breathing chapter, you know, seemingly effortlessly, of course, I'm sure it wasn't, but it seemed that way, really helped me to break my own mental logjam of doing my own writing, which is sort of built up over years of editing other people's books and seeing bad and good manuscripts cross my desk in an endless succession.
Mm-hmm. And I think that your publisher, Warner Books, has really done a nice job building an audience for your work. And it seems like you're accreting an audience. And I think that's one of the reasons you're having the success when you hit the bestseller list, because you have a very dedicated, passionate reading audience, which is really hard to develop these days.
It's true. We have a really loyal audience, and we're really lucky to have people like that. They're not afraid to tell us when we mess up. You know, they come and see us at signings, and they write to us and let us know what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and they, you know, are really loyal to us, and we couldn't be more thankful for that.
I really appreciate all the time you've given us today, and what would you like your readers to know the most about The Wheel of Darkness now that it's in the stores and you know, doing well? What are you guys happiest about that you achieved with The Wheel of Darkness that perhaps you didn't see in other novels you've written?
Well, I think that the setting is really special in The Wheel of Darkness. I mean, it is so extraordinary. These ocean, I mean, it's a very real setting. We haven't, you know, created anything that doesn't really exist. They're so luxurious, so vast, and so huge, and with everything on board that you could possibly want. And here they are in the middle of the ocean. You know, you don't have any option of getting off this ship, because the ship is beyond reach of helicopters, it's beyond reach of most coast guards. So here you are in the middle of the ocean, all alone, at the mercy of weather and of the ocean, and yet you still have all the luxuries of civilization. I just love I think that we really did a good job with that setting and creating a building sense of terror and fear and loss of control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're claustrophobic, there's going to be some scenes in The Wheel of Darkness which are going to challenge you a little bit, because it does kind of cater to that kind of inner fear, I think, that's a real primal emotion that people have.
Yes, and you know, we both Link and I are sort of claustrophobic ourselves. We tend to write about the thing that we fear the most, and I also have a terrible fear of, you know, being in the water, in, you know, bottomless water at night in the middle of the ocean, and we exploit that fear as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terribly claustrophobic, and Doug is very patient with you know, my setting things in places, you know, like deep subway tunnels or you know, sub basements and things that where you can't get out of them. And you're right, we exploit that, you know, we exploit that to the max. I'm also very proud of how Constance Greene develops in this book. You know, I've got a soft spot for her, and she's a bit of a bizarre character. And for a while there, we weren't quite sure if or how she would flourish, and she really seems to have come into her own, I think, in this novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with us today. I'd like to thank Voice Core Reading Service for giving us the studio. This is the first time that we've ever had two guests on at the same time, and I'm really happy for you guys that you're having the success you're having, and I look forward to catching up with you down the road when the next novel comes out.
Well, thank you very much for having us. We really enjoyed the conversation.
Great.
Yes, thank you, Casey.
Thank you. Our guests today were Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. We've been discussing The Wheel of Darkness, published by Warner Books. This is the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words.